1.03. Ascraeus Mons was a volcano, yet the atmosphere within the chamber of the first was anything but warm. The fortress of Legio Tempestus had been one of the earliest established on Mars in ancient times, and as one of the highest volcanoes on the Red Planet, it was fitting that it housed one of its most ancient and respected Titan orders. Carved within the basalt rock of the mountain, the domain of Tempestus was known as a place of courage and wisdom, a place where warriors of honour came to settle their disputes without violence. Indius Cavallario watched from the Princeps Gallery as emissaries from many of the great legios took their seats within the great amphitheatre carved into the cliffs of the enormous caldera of his order's fortress, knowing the smiles and warm greetings being exchanged hid undercurrents of mistrust and widening divisions. Divisions that were becoming all too common on Mars. There was Grandmaster Maxen Vledig of the Deathbolts conversing with Princeps Senioris Ulrike of the Deathstalkers, their apparent bonhomie masking decades of disputes involving ancient territorial rights along the borders of the Lunae Palace and Arcadia regions. Across the hall, encased in his life-sustaining exoskeleton and aloof from all others, was Princeps Grain of Legio Destructor. A dozen others had answered the call to attend the Council of Tharsis, as Lord Commander Verticorda had already dubbed it with his usual taste for the grandiose. Only Mortis was yet to appear. Verticorda stood in the centre of the grand echoing amphitheatre, leaning on his ebony, thunderbolt-embossed cane, and swathed in the shadow of Deus Tempestus, the first god-machine of Legio Tempestus. Towering over the assembled warriors, the great steel engine had stood sentinel over the deliberations of Legio Tempestus for half a millennium, its majesty undimmed and its power tangible, though it had not moved so much as a single joint in over 200 years. Next to Verticorda was Lord Commander Catarix, the hunched ancient warrior's brother-in-arms and fellow master of the Knights of Taranis. Where Verticorda was aged and revered for his wisdom, the newly appointed Catarix was beloved for his fiery passion, which complemented his fellow commander's more cautious temperament. Ever since Verticorda had bent his knee to the Emperor nearly 200 years ago, the joint commanders of the Knights of Taranis had served as the Princeps Conciliatus between the warrior orders of Mars. It would be their job to ensure that the coming gathering was conducted in a manner befitting the most ancient warrior guilds, that tradition was upheld and honourable discourse permitted. Cavallario did not envy them that role, for tensions were running high, and this latest insult to an adept of Mars had pushed the mightiest warrior orders of Mars close to open confrontation, a state of affairs that had not transpired on the Red Sands for uncounted centuries. Not only that, but warriors from the Knights of Taranis had been involved in this latest combat, so they were hardly likely to be objective. Verticorda could be trusted to keep his anger in check, but Catarix paced the mosaic floor of the chamber like a caged beast. Skirmishes between orders were far from uncommon. After all, warriors needed outlets for their aggression to develop their skills and foment the proper bellicose attitude needed to command the god-machines. Lately, these had threatened to boil over into outright warfare. The sheer affront of the attack on a Pluvium Maximal's fusion reactor on the slopes of Ulysses Petera had sent shockwaves through the Martian community. Though to call such a competitive, uncooperative, suspicious, and insular organization as the Mechanicum a community seemed perverse to Cavallario. He ran a hand over his scalp, the surface hairless and punctured by sealed implant plugs at his nape that allowed him to command the mighty engines of Legio Tempestus. Similar implants were fused to his spine, and haptic receptors grafted to the soles of his feet and along the tactile surfaces of each of his hands allowed him to feel the Titan's steel body as though it were his own flesh. Cavallario's frame was tall and wiry, the dress uniform that had once fitted his well-proportioned frame snugly now hanging from his thin body, the result of decades spent vicariously exerting himself through the actions of a warlord battle titan instead of in the gymnasium. As he looked over at the mighty form of Deus Tempestus, he found himself longing to ascend the elevator to his own venerable war machine, Victorix Magna, The glowing iron face of the ancient war machine stared down at him, the head of a mechanical god of war that lived in his dreams every night. In those dreams, he would be striding across the ashen red plains of Mars on his last march, Deus Tempestus responding to his every command with the familiarity of two warriors who had fought shoulder to shoulder since their earliest days. Each time he would wake and, finding sleep impossible, walk through the darkened, sparsely populated hangars of the Ascreus Mons. The hangars were largely empty, since the bulk of the Legio's strength was deployed throughout the War Master's expedition forces, pushing the extremities of the Emperor's realm ever outwards and bringing the last worlds of the galaxy under the sway of the Imperium. His steps would unerringly lead him to the Chamber of the First, where he would watch the sunrise, staring up at the shadowed form of the colossal war machine, its weapons silent and its war banners fluttering in the downdrafts from above. Cavallario's brothers fought under the command of Lord Gilliman, and he could think of no better warrior to lead so august a legio. He and the few battle titans now back on Mars were approaching the end of their refit after campaigning in the Epsiloid binary cluster against the Greenskin, and would soon rejoin the war to assure humanity's birthright to rule the stars. He eagerly awaited their redeployment, for life beyond the cockpit of a Titan was made up of long moments of incompleteness, every experience deadened. His physical surroundings were bland and tasteless without first being filtered through the manifold of his battle Titan. The moment of connection with an engine was painful, as though it resented the time spent separated from its commander, and it took time to wrestle the warlike heart of the machine to compliance. But once that union had been achieved, oh, how like a god did it feel to be master of the battlefield and lord of so terrible and mighty a power. Separation was no less painful. The angry need of the Titan to walk made it disinclined to allow its commander to leave without punishment. Aching bones, thudding headaches, and searing dislocation were the hallmarks of a separation, and each time was harder than the last. For now it was possible for Cavallario to retain some semblance of humanity, to walk as a man, but he knew it was only a matter of time before he would require a more permanent enmeshing within an amniotic float tank of liquid information. The thought terrified him. He shook off such fears as he saw a ripple of motion near the floor of the chamber and heard a murmur of agitation pass through the chamber of the first. Cavallario looked down from the gallery, seeing two warriors in long dark cloaks and grinning skull-faced helmets stride into the chamber with purpose and strength. Legio Mortis had arrived.
"You deny that your order took part in the attack on Adept Maximal's reactor?" demanded Lord Commander Catarix. "That engines of the Legio Mortis willfully destroyed an artifact of technology and endangered the lives of warriors from the Knights of Tyrannus?"
"Of course I do,"
snapped Princeps Camulos, his hooded features making no secret of his disdain for the accusation and his accuser. Despite Verticorda's cautious welcome to the assembly, Catarix had wasted no time in setting the tone by marching straight towards the senior princeps of the Legio Mortis and all but calling him out for the damage done to his warriors in the reactor's explosion. Cavallario watched the young Lord Commander, the youngest in the history of the Knights of Tyrannus, sneer at Princeps Camulos's answer, plainly disbelieving what he was hearing. He watched as Catarix circled like a shark in the water with the scent of blood, forced to admire his nerve in facing down so senior a princeps. Men had been rendered down into servitors for less. Legio Mortis's disdain for the Knight Orders was well known, as was their reluctance to share power in the Tharsis region from their fortress within Pavonis Mons. With the destruction of Adept Maximal's forge, it would be difficult for many of the local warrior orders to remain viable, leaving Mortis the undisputed masters of Tharsis, one of the most abundant and productive regions of Mars. All of which was enough for the finger of suspicion to point squarely at Legio Mortis, but not enough to hang them. Mortis and Tempestus had long been rivals for dominance of Tharsis, but was that enough to condemn Camulos and openly damn his Legio with this new atrocity? Camulos was a towering bear of a man, more suited at first glance to be the chieftain of a tribe of bloodthirsty barbarian warriors, but his sheer self-belief and aggressive nature made him a natural Titan commander, easily able to bend the will of a war machine to his own. His armour was black and glistening as though lacquered, the death's head emblem upon his broad shoulder guards a gruesome testament to his legio's famed ruthlessness.
"I did not come here to be barked at," snarled Camulos. "Keep your young pup on a tight leash, Verticorda, or I may break him for you."
Verticorda nodded slowly.
"The question is withdrawn, Honourable Princeps."
Catterix whipped his head around to face his fellow Lord Commander, but a stern glare from Verticorda silenced the angry outburst that Cavallario saw gathering in his throat.
"This council is not a trial, or indeed any kind of inquiry," continued Verticorda, his voice laden with centuries of authority and redolent with wisdom. "It is an organized debate, whereby the warrior orders of the Tharsis region might gather to discuss the troubles afflicting our world, and decide how to meet them without further bloodshed. Adept Maximal has suffered a grievous loss to his holdings, but we are not gathered here to assign blame, but to see how we, as the guardians of Mars, might avoid such things in the future."
Cavallario looked over to where the robed form of Epluvium Maximal stood, in the shadow of Deus Tempestus, as though he took comfort in the nearness of so complex and revered a machine. Adept Maximal had joined the proceedings immediately after the arrival of the Legio Mortis, his corpulent machine frame wreathed in icy puffs of air vented from the layers of thermal barrier fabrics that cooled the spinning data wheels that made up the bulk of his body. His head was an oblong helmet of gold, fitted with a multitude of lenses upon telescopic armatures, and a morass of sheathed coolant cables emerged from beneath his robes like black tentacles, upon which sat hololithic plates streaming with glowing lines of data. So far Maximal had said nothing, save to acknowledge the primacy of Verticorda and Catterix in the proceedings, content simply to watch and record events as they unfolded.
"And how do you suggest we do that?" asked Camulos. "By accusing honourable orders of warriors of acts of piracy? To suggest that we would stoop so low as to attack the holdings of an adept so highly regarded as Adept Maximal is outrageous!"
Cavallario looked over as Maximal inclined his golden head at Camulos's compliment. The words felt too tacked on to be believable. For all his bluster, the raid on Maximal's reactor bore all the hallmarks of Legio Mortis, swift, brutal, and leaving virtually no survivors. Only the three knights had survived to speak of the attack, and all of them had suffered severe damage to their machines in the reactor's detonation. Gun camera footage of the confrontation had been lost in the explosion, and the only clue to the identity of the attacker was a brief description from the sole knight who had seen the machine.
"In any case, what possible reason could Legio Mortis have for undertaking such an act? We are all servants of the War Master, are we not?"
Mixed murmurs of assent and disagreement spread around the chamber, and Cavallario felt his collar rise that so many could blindly agree with so facile a statement. Rivalry or not, such a comment could not go unanswered. Cavallario rose from his seat in the Princeps Gallery and said,
"You mean the Empress forces, surely?"
Heads turned as he rose to his feet and awkwardly descended the steel steps towards the chamber's floor. Camulos watched him approach, squaring his shoulders as though they were about to brawl.
"The War Master is the Emperor's proxy. It is one and the same."
"No, actually," replied Cavallario, taking the floor. "It's not."
"The chamber recognizes Princeps Cavallario, the Storm Lord of Legio Tempestus," said Verticorda, using the war name his Legio had given him in the early days of his command.
Cavallario gave a respectful bow to the Lord Commander and then to Deus Tempestus before turning to Princeps Camulos. The man's wide shoulders and enormous presence dwarfed him.
"Pray tell, why is it not the same thing?" demanded Camulos.
"The armies we serve are those of the Emperor, not the War Master," said Cavallario. "No matter that Horus Lupercal commands them, every man, woman, and machine that fights in this crusade is a servant of the Emperor."
"You are splitting hairs," spat Camulos, turning away.
"No," repeated Cavallario, "I am not. I know that your Legio has pledged a great deal of its strength to the 63rd Expedition and to the War Master. I believe that to be dangerous."
Camulos turned back towards him.
"Dangerous? To swear loyalty to the glorious warrior who commands the military might of the Imperium while the Emperor retreats to the dungeons beneath his palace? To swear loyalty to the hero who will finish the job the Emperor is too busy to finish? That is dangerous.
The Wallmaster is a sublime warrior, agreed Cavallario, but it would be a mistake to think of those armies as belonging to him. Our first loyalty must be to the Emperor, and only a blind man could fail to see how this division is affecting Mars.
What are you talking about, Cavallario?
Snapped Camulus.
You know what I'm talking about. Nothing is said and nothing is ever recorded, but we all know that lines are being drawn. The divisions between the adepts of Mars grow ever more vocal and bitter. Long-buried schisms are stirred and ancient feuds reignited. The attack on Adept Maximal's reactor is just the latest example of violence that's rising to the surface and spilling out onto the red sands. The factions of belief are mobilizing, and our world is on the verge of tearing itself apart. And for what? A semantic difference in belief? Is such a thing worth the bloodshed it will no doubt unleash?
Sometimes war is necessary, said Camulos. Did not the Primarch Alpharius say that war was simply the galaxy's hygiene?
Who knows? It is certainly attributed to him. But what weight do his words carry on Mars? Any war fought here will not be for hygiene, but for misguided beliefs and differences in theology. Such things are anathema to the Imperium, and I will not be drawn into war by the beliefs of religious madmen.
Madmen, said Camulos,
with exaggerated horror.
You speak of the senior adepts of Mars? Such words from a respected princeps!
Cavallario ignored the barb and addressed his next words to the assembled princeps and warriors of the Titan Orders.
Every day, the legios and warrior orders receive petitions from forges all over Tharsis, begging our engines to walk. And for what? Differences of opinion in belief? It is madness that will see us all burn in the fires of an unnecessary war, and I for one will not lead my warriors into battle for such things. The Legios have always been the defenders of Mars, and we have always stood above the squabbles of the Mechanicum. We have always done so, and must do so now. We must not allow ourselves to be baited.
True sons of Mars know that the fire of the forge burns hottest when it burns away impurities, retorted Camulus. If blood must be shed to preserve the glory of Mars, then so be it. Kelbor Hal, the Fabricator General of Mars himself, receives emissaries from the Warmaster, and the great Forge Masters Ertzi Malevolus and Lucas Crom have already pledged their labors to Horus Lupercal. Who are we to doubt their wisdom?
Then this is not about belief, said Cavallario. It's rebellion you're talking about.
A gasp of horror swept the chamber at Cavallario's words. To even speak of such things was unheard of. Camulos shook his head.
You're a naive fool, Cavallario. The things you speak of have been in motion for centuries, ever since the Emperor arrived here and enslaved the Mechanicum to his will.
You speak out of turn, cried Lord Commander Verticorda. This is treachery.
An angry hubbub filled the chamber of the first, with princeps, moderati, engineers, steersmen and armsmen rising to protest, either at Camulos's words or at Verticorda's accusation. Following Cavallario's example, the senior princeps of Legio Mortis turned to the shouting warriors and said,
We are shackled to the demands of Terra, my friends. But I ask you, why that should be? We were promised freedom from interference, but what freedom have we enjoyed? Our every effort is bent to the will of the Emperor, our every forge dedicated to fulfilling his vision. But what of our vision? Was Mars not promised the chance to reclaim its own empire? The forge worlds, long ago founded in the depths of the galaxy, are still out there awaiting the tread of any Martian sun. But how long will it be before the Emperor claims them? I tell you now, brothers, that when those worlds are held by Terra, it will be next to impossible to reclaim them.
Camulus turned his gaze upon Deus Tempestus and said,
Princeps Cavallario is right about one thing, though. A storm is approaching where our vaunted neutrality will not stand. You will all need to choose a side. Choose the right one, or it will devour even you, Stormlord.
Dahlia stared at the complex lines radiating from the plans before her, the notations in a tightly wound Gothic script that made reading them next to impossible. Numbers, equations, and handwritten notes conspired to make the confusing arrangement of circuit diagrams, build arrangements, and milling plans almost unintelligible.
"Give it up, Dahlia," said Zouche, with his customary angry tone. "We've all been over this 100 times. It doesn't make any sense."
Dahlia shook her head. "No, it does. It's just a case of following the path." "There is no path," said Melisande, her voice arch and weary. "Don't you think I've tried to follow the plans?"
"It looks like Adep Ulterimus didn't think the standard methodology applied to his own work."
Dahlia rested her arms on the wax paper upon which the plans had been printed. These, of course, were not the originals, which had been drawn many thousands of years ago, but copies transcribed by later adepts over the centuries. She closed her eyes and let out a deep breath. She knew she ought to be used to the defeatist carping of her fellows, but their daily negativity was beginning to get to her. She took a calming breath, picturing the oceans of Leiran, as described by the poet Edwin Moore in his Ocean Cantos, which she'd transcribed nearly a year ago. The image of that far-distant planet's world oceans always calmed her, and she badly needed that calm now, for time was running out. No sooner had Coriel Zeth welcomed Dahlia to her mighty forge than the adept had turned on her heel and marched deep into the sweltering depths, announcing that Dahlia was being taken to where she would be tested. Dahlia had never been comfortable with tests, knowing she tended to clam up and her mind go blank whenever she was asked a difficult question, let alone made to sit any form of exam. She often wondered how she'd managed to pass her transcription assessments. The gleaming halls of the Magma City were spacious and functional, geometrically precise and machined with a smooth grace. Though there was utter devotion to function in its architecture, form was not overlooked, and there was great beauty in the mechanisms of Zeth's forge. Menials and lowly adepts threaded the halls, chambers, and cavernous workspaces, every one according Adept Zeth the proper respect as she passed. Each new chamber brought fresh wonders of engineering and construction. Enormous cogged machines surrounded by crackling arcs of lightning. Thudding pistons driving unknown engines and enormous caverns of steel where thousands of technomats toiled at bronze workbenches on the tiniest mechanisms with delicate silver calipers and needle-nosed instrumentation. At last, they came to a wide chamber lined with rack upon rack of gleaming tools and fabrication devices that she could not even begin to name. A tall plan chest stood at one end of the chamber, and four robed individuals stood around a workbench at its center, each one shaking her hand and nodding as she was introduced to them. First was Melisande, a tall, handsome woman of middling years from the American continent, with smooth brown skin and a grafted augmetic faceplate over the left side of her face. She had been coolly welcoming, her remaining eye sizing Dahlia up and down with the look of a professional assayer. Next was a swarthy, stunted individual by the name of Zouche, a native of what had once been known as the Indonesic Block. His handshake was curt, and his brusque welcome had a hollow ring to it. Dahlia was not tall by any means, but even she towered over Zouche. She estimated his height at no more than a meter. Next to Zouche was a woman named Severine, who had the look of a teacher about her. Her hair was pulled into a tight ponytail, and her pale-skinned features looked as though they might crack if her thin lips creased open with even the fraction of a smile. Last was a smiling youth who went by the name of Caxton, perhaps a year or two older than Dahlia, with a boyish face and a tonsured mop of unruly black hair. His features were open, and of all the greetings she had received, his felt the most genuine, and she recognized his accent as having its origins somewhere not too distant from her own homelands, possibly the eastern slopes of the Urals. With introductions made, Adept Zeth had lifted a number of waxy sheets of paper from the plan chest and laid them flat on the workbench in the center of the room.
"This," she announced, "is one of the last great unrealized designs of Adept Ulterimus, developer of the Sigma Phi Desolator engine. Data appellations name it as a theta wave enhancer designed to stimulate long-term potentiation in humans."
Ignoring their blank looks, Zeth continued.
"It has been transcribed faithfully by the tech archivists of Epluvium Maximal from the data fragments recovered from Adept Ulterimus's tomb below the Zephyria Tholos,
and you are going to build it. You will have access to workspace, tools, materials, and servitors to perform the manual labor. Within 7 rotations, you will demonstrate a working prototype.
With that, Adept Zeth had departed with a swirl of her bronze cape, leaving the 5 of them alone in the workspace. The first day had been spent in working out what the device was intended to do. No small feat in itself, given that the transcribers had been literal in copying out Alteramus's spelling mistakes, corrections, and the exact shape and texture of his many crossed-out workings. Sketched images and rough diagrams scattered throughout the plans gave some clue to the device's function, but it was a painstaking process just to divine what requirement this unrealized device was intended to fulfill. A pecking order had quickly established itself within their group, with Zoosh and Caxton deferring to Severine, who in turn took her lead from Melisande. Dahlia found her place within that hierarchy when she alone was able to decipher the notes and diagrams enough to understand the device's purpose.
"It's a machine for enhancing the communication between neurons in the brain," said Dahlia,
after a frustrating hour of unravelling a thread of randomly scrawled notes.
"According to these notes, Alteramus seemed to believe that a process known as long-term potentiation was what lay at the heart of the formation of memory and learning. It seems to be a cellular mechanism of learning, where the body is induced to synthesize new proteins that assist in high-level cognition."
"How does it do that?" asked Severine, looking up from redrawing the circuit diagrams and synaptic flow maps.
"By the looks of this molecular formula, it achieves its function by enhancing synaptic transmission," said Dahlia, her eyes darting rapidly over the drawings. "This wave generator vastly improves the ability of 2 neurons, one presynaptic and the other postsynaptic, to communicate with one another across a synapse."
Dahlia's fingers spiraled over the drawing, her eyes flitting back and forth across the paper and her own notations, oblivious to the look she was receiving from her fellows as she spoke, the words sounding as though they came from the deepest recesses of her brain.
"Neurotransmitter molecules are received by receptors on the surface of the postsynaptic cell. When it's active, the device improves the postsynaptic cell's sensitivity to neurotransmitters by increasing the activity of existing receptors and vastly increasing the number of receptors on the postsynaptic cell surface."
"Yes, but what does that actually mean?" asked Caxton.
"Isn't it obvious?"
asked Dahlia, looking up from the plan. The silence of her fellows told her it was not. She tapped the plans with her fingertips and said,
"The device is designed to enormously enhance a person's ability to tap into areas of the brain that we almost never use, increasing their ability to learn and store information at a rate way beyond anything human beings have ever been able to achieve before."
"But it doesn't work," pointed out Caxton.
"Not yet," agreed Dahlia. "But I think I know how we can make it work."
"Do you think she is right?"
asked Epluvian Maximal, watching Dahlia explaining the function of Alteramus's device on a flickering holoscreen.
"Can she get it to work? No one else has succeeded in 1,000 years, and you think she can do it in 7 rotations?"
Coriel Zeth didn't answer her fellow adept for a moment, letting the chilled gusts of air that wafted from his permanently cooled data frame tease the few organic portions of her flesh that still faced the world. Maximal's words were artificially rendered, but Adept Lundqvist had crafted his vox unit, and the sound of his voice was virtually indistinguishable from an organically created one. Such an affectation seemed ridiculous to Zeth, given the artificiality of the rest of Epluvium Maximal. But every adept had his own particular idiosyncrasies, and she supposed hers might seem no less ridiculous to others.
"I believe she can," said Zeth.
Her voice was still created by human vocal cords, but rendered hollow and metallic by the studded face mask she wore. She wasn't used to employing her flesh voice, but indulged Maximal's peccadillo without complaint.
"You saw the schema of the device she altered on Terra? How could she have done that without some unconscious connection to the Akasha?"
"Blind luck," suggested Maximal. "A million servitors working on 1,000,000 plans might eventually hit upon something that works by accident."
"That old truism," smiled Zeth. "You know that's impossible."
"Is it? I've seen a few of my servitors perform tasks that weren't included in their doctrina wafers, though admittedly my servitors do not function as ably as I would prefer."
only because Lucas Crumb outbid you for the services of Adept Ravashol. But that's beside the point, said Zeth, irritated by Maximal's digression. Dahlia Cythera made intuitive leaps of logic, and where she found gaps in the technology, she filled them with working substitutes.
And you believe that is because the organic architecture of her brain is attuned to the Akasha?
Given that I have eliminated various other factors that might account for her innate understanding of technology, it is the only explanation that fits, replied Zeth. Though she does not know it, she unconsciously accesses the wellspring of all knowledge and experience contained within the Akasha, encoded in the substance of the ether.
By ether you mean the warp?
Yes.
So why not call it that?
You know why not, cautioned Zeth. There is danger in such association, and I do not want prying eyes misunderstanding the concept of what we are trying to do here. Not before we fully understand the processes by which we can access the Akashic records and learn that which our ancient forebears understood without the need for dogma and superstition.
The source of all knowledge, sighed Maximal, and Zeth smiled beneath her mask. Appealing to Maximal's obsessive hunger for knowledge was a surefire means of quashing any concerns he had regarding their work.
Indeed, said Zeth,
baiting the hook some more.
The history of the cosmos and every morsel of information that has ever existed or ever will exist.
If she can build this device, then we will be able to unlock the full potential of the Great Reader.
That is my hope, agreed Zeth,
running a golden hand across the icy surface of Maximal's chill body. She could feel the subtle vibration of the data wheels churning within the mechanisms of his body, as though in anticipation of learning the innermost workings of the universe.
If she can build Alteramis's device, then we can enhance the empath's mind to the degree where it will be fully receptive to the knowledge impressed upon the ether. Then we will know everything.
Yes, the empath, said Maximal. The use of a psyker disturbs me. If Dahlia Cythera already has a connection to the ether, why not simply use her as the conduit?
Zeth shook her head. Prolonged exposure to the ether eventually burns the conduit out. There are plenty of psykers to be had, but Dahlia is one of a kind. I would not be so careless with such a valuable resource as to squander her.
Her answers seemed to satisfy Maximal, and he said, It is great work we do here. But there will be those who seek to stop us if they should learn of it.
Then we must ensure that they do not.
Of course, nodded Maximal. But already I detect the interest of the Fabricator General and his cronies in the work carried out in your forge. Info feeds gossip on the air, and data packets are like bodies. They do not stay buried forever. You are a brilliant technologist, but you make few allies with your open scorn for Kelbor Hal. Be careful you do not make too many enemies and attract undue attention. Such things may cost us dearly.
You speak of the attack on your reactor?
Amongst other things, replied Maximal, watching the holographic image of Dahlia as she organized her fellow workers in their tasks. At the Council of Tharsis, Princeps Camulos denied involvement in the attack, and, much as it surprises me, I believe him.
Really? From what I gather, Mortis are agitating for open warfare between the factions.
True. And the destruction of my prime reactor would be a logical first step in weakening their strongest opponent, Legio Tempestus, for they greatly depended on its output.
The Magma City will cover their shortfall.
I told Princeps Cavallario that very thing, said Maximal. But you and I both know that is only a temporary solution. Mortis and Tempestus are rivals of old, and with the reactor gone, the strength of those friendly to our cause grows weaker.
So, why do you not suspect Legio Mortis' involvement?
Maximal sighed, another affectation since he had no lungs to speak of, and a mist of cold air billowed around him. Camulos's bluster was too confident. He knew we couldn't prove anything because there was nothing to prove. He may have helped plan the attack, but I do not believe any engines from Mortis took part.
Then who did?
I believe Crumb was behind the execution.
Crumb. Because you do not like him.
I find his manner insufferable, that is true. But there is more to it than that, said Maximal, with a precisely modulated conspiratorial tone of voice. There are rumors of the work he is pursuing in his forge, experiments on engines designed with artificial sentience.
Rumors? What rumors? I have heard nothing of this, said Zeth.
Few have, said Maximal slyly. But few things escape my data miners. It is whispered that Crom has even built such an engine. Supposedly, it matches the description given by the night pilot who saw the machine that attacked my reactor.
Zeth shook her head. If Crom has built an engine with artificial sentience, he would be a fool to let it be destroyed.
Perhaps it wasn't destroyed, said Maximal. If it escaped into the Palladus, we could search for 100 years and not find it.
Zeth sensed hesitancy in Maximal's manner, as though there were other facts he was aware of, but was unsure about sharing.
Is there something else? She asked.
Maximal nodded slowly.
Perhaps. Each time a rumor of this machine surfaces, the data conduits whisper a name. Caban.
Zeth ran the name through her internal memory coils, but found no match for it. Maximal read her lack of information in the streams of data floating in her infosphere, and said,
Even I can find only the most cryptic reference to Caban in the vaults. Supposedly he was an ancient potentate of the Gyptus who built the lost pyramid of Zawiyat el Arian. Though in the few hieratic records that remain, his name is transliterated as Kaba, which may either imply dynastic problems or simply that the scribe was unable to fully decipher his name from a more ancient record.
And the relevance of this?
Purely academic, admitted Maximal. But, interestingly, the records hint that Kaba may be the king's Horus name.
A Horus name? What is that?
Asked Zeth, knowing that Maximal loved to show off the vast expanse of his archives and his knowledge of ancient times.
The kings of Gyptus often chose names that symbolized their worldly power and spiritual might to act as a kind of mission statement for their rule, said Maximal,
and Zeth could hear the whir of data wheels as he called up more information.
Usually the king's name was carved upon a representation of his palace with an image of the god Horus perched beside it.
The god Horus?
Indeed. The name is an ancient one, said Maximal. A god of the sky, of the sun, and, of course, war. The ancient Egyptians so enjoyed their war.
And what did this Horus name symbolize?
Asked Zeth, intrigued despite herself.
No one knows for sure, but it seems likely that it was to imply that Kaba was an earthly embodiment of Horus, an enactor of his will, if you like.
So you are suggesting that this machine, whatever it is, was built for Horus Lupercal.
That would be a logical conclusion, especially as Crom enjoys the favor of the Fabricator General, and we all know whose voice he listens to.
I have heard this before, but I cannot believe Kelbor Hal values the Council of the Warmaster over the Emperor.
No. I hear that Regulus has recently arrived in the solar system with missives from the 63rd Expedition. And his first port of call is Mars, not Terra.
That doesn't prove anything, pointed out Zeth. Regulus is an adept of the Mechanicum. There is no reason to suspect any ulterior motive behind his coming to Mars first.
Perhaps not, agreed Maximal. But when was the last time an emissary from the fleets reported to Mars before the Sigillite of Terra?